that 75A is where it stops. So we're really there at the end. So close to the finish line, we can see it. And that last leg. We'll learn today. We'll do a little bit of the same kind of expansive learning that we did last time because of the way that this Gemara goes. It's true, we could learn each of the limudim and we could see the repetition of the way the rabbis are arguing and that the logic comes into focus. But we also want to go outside the text a little bit to see how the Gemara is moved into play in rabbinic literature. So last time we looked at the verse, "Don't stand idly by the blood of your brother," and we looked at some of the sources that really went along with that verse and how the Gemara used it versus how some of the other Mefarshim, some of the other commentaries understood it. Today, we're going to go and we're going to take from part of the Gemara that really is going to talk about even the way, if you want to say, we wind up enacting the law of rodef, meaning if someone's chasing another person, that person can be sacrificed vis-a-vis his life, can be sacrificed, the person chasing can be killed, even before, right, we said, even before he's actually done the crime of killing the other person. So we talked about the fuzziness of that judgment, and we talked about, you know, that seems a little radical, that he hasn't even done anything, and therefore this set of witnesses is becoming like, you know, judge, jury, and executioner, and, oh, I forgot to turn this off. Oh, hi. So, judge, jury, and executioner. But what I want to see tonight is exactly where that goes in terms of the Rambam. Because the Rambam is, in a certain sense, summarizing what the Gemara is saying and bringing together all the thought of the rabbis in many cases. Okay. I made high copies of the material. So someone's going to have to share already. This is beautiful. It's a beautiful kind of problem to have. But before we get into any of the Gemara, there's an overarching piece here that I think is okay to note again, and that is that the Mishnah that we're in, which set out on page 73A1, before we go to 74A, As I asked us last time to compare the list of those crimes for which a person could be killed if he was about to commit them versus crimes that a person is about to commit for which we say he cannot be killed, I said, what's the difference? And we noticed that the difference in those crimes was that one affected impacted human beings, and one we said either might be impactful on society or at least are impactful towards religious legislation. The way that that commentary, the way that that question was borne out in a little learning that I did this week in a book called Hebrew Criminal Law by Hyman Golden. You'll have it a little later when we get into some of the other source material that I have here. He said, in justifying the taking of a life to prevent the commission of a crime, the Jewish jurists draw a distinction between crimes against man, which are male in se, crimes and crimes against religion, which are male prohibita, or prohibition. So in the former, where the commission of the crime would directly concern the life or the honor of the intended victim, homicide is declared to be justifiable. In the latter, where the commission of the crime would not directly affect the life or honor of another human being, it is impermissible to take the life of the would-be offender, no matter how heinous the crime may be in the eyes of the law, and no matter how dangerous the crime may prove to the institutions of the country. So that commentary that he's writing reflects the conversation we had in our Beit Midrash on the pursuit of what this Mishnah really is all about. So I thought that was a good kind of mirror or parallel source to the actual living conversation that we had here in the Beit Midrash. We noted that. What the classical sources do not note, in a sense, is that kind of currency of thought that we have to somehow again and again ask ourselves the question, what is this matter of the honor lost to a woman who was raped, and what do we really make of the Gemara dealing with these types of crimes and the honor lost to a woman? And especially knowing that in the ancient world, the dishonor that causes creates a system, you know, or at least the Bible presents a system where, for the loss of her honor, a fine is paid to the father, and that kind of a system where it doesn't say immediately anyone goes out for a vengeance killing as a response, at least in the Gemara here, or in the law vis-a-vis criminal jurisprudence, because part of the trope, again, in this whole picture is, are we really trying to send people out to be vigilantes? Or are we only talking about moments that we can actually affect and impact ourselves, the crime happening in front of our eyes? That we have to notice that that is brought into the picture here, not to adjudicate that matter, but to really reflect deeply about it in terms of this kind of notion that there are certain crimes for which one should become involved proactively. And that is as terrible as someone murdering someone. Well, it may not be that you could take his life. Or is it? And of course it is, because if someone's going after a betrothed nara, it does fall into the category of one whose life can be completely taken from him. We can protect that young lady from this pursuer with his life. But then the Gemara says, but how am I going to temper any kind of either apparent vigilantism, or how am I going to put some rules and laws to kind of put in check our immediate kind of willingness to make ourselves judge, jury, and executioner? So what's fascinating then on Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph 74a, to pick up from there, because we've now learned through 73 the majority of it, I want to go and look at, from the beginning of 74a, the Gemara inside, where Rav Papa begins. So 74a1. Rav Papa Amar. Actually, let's just flip back. Sorry, 73b4. We're in a case where, and again, everything goes by way of thinking about the different cases that could possibly come up in the ancient world and the relationships that aren't exactly sorted out, but here we have a little bit of an incestual crime that's going to be committed, or not, depending on the level of her willingness to engage in this act of relations, or her being forced to, we don't really know. It's going to ultimately drive some of the conversation. Rava Amar, b'manichato shelo yahargenu, discussing a case where a sister allows her brother to actually violate her so that he won't kill her. So, the Gemara presents pictures of people, of course, who, in essence, bring us all the way back to the beginning of the parak. Ben Sorer Amore. This is a stubborn and rebellious child. Maybe this is a rebellious child in this way. This is a stubborn, rebellious, forget murderous, but murderous of this woman's honor. So again, part of the trope in here is all going back to the beginning of the parak. For Rabbi Yehuda, he, and the Mishnah's following the view of Rabbi Yehuda, who holds that such a woman may not be saved at the cost of the pursuer's life. Since the assailant may not be killed, he's fined. Now, that is, I'm at the end of 73b, just turning over to 74a. So I just wanted to put the case into focus that we don't allow him to be killed because she, in essence, is at this point having to make a decision between either being violated or giving up her life. Okay? So Amar Rav Papa, 74a. Bimifuta. The Mishnah is referring to a case where the sister is seduced. And if you look at the footnote, a man who seduces a Na'ara like one who rapes her must pay a fine of these 50 shekels. The Divrei HaKol, and it thus follows all views, not just the view of Rabbi Yehuda. That is that even Rabbi Yehuda's disputants agree that if the woman actually consents to cohabit illicitly with a man, we may not kill him to prevent the cohabitation. Since he may not be killed during the cohabitation, he becomes liable for the fine. So where they can, in essence, find the space to say, you have to be very careful about whether or not you can really kill this guy, because there might have been some consent on behalf of this other person, you have to think twice. Now, for all intents and purposes, they're using an example of a sister and a brother. One might not think right away that one would ever allow that if one knew the law of Torah. Therefore, says another commentary that I looked at, we never really stop ourselves from taking the life of the pursuer. The rodef is the rodef. The one who pursues is the one who pursues. And if we have to use lethal force to stop the crime, we do. Remember at one point, we also talked about how difficult it might be to actually step in and do this. To actually step in and use lethal force and to take another's life, especially trying to figure out if in fact something really wrong is happening. My take on the sugya then is that at some point someone could legally try to compel oneself to find some quote-unquote legal loophole that might stop me from actually doing this. And the Gemara is kind of already saying that out loud and having us think about deeply whether or not we could follow through at all.
It's going to come out right, but where there's consent by the sister, at that point it sounds less like a crime against a person than a crime against the Torah or religion, so I'm not sure why in that case you can attack or kill to stop that crime against.
Well, actually, Rabbi Yehuda and all of them don't allow for that killing to happen.
They don't.
They say that because it's a crime against, exactly like you said. But what I'm suggesting is that the thinking that it's causing within us is, okay, but they're using that one particular case. But in most cases, is that the case, that it's a brother and a sister? Most cases, it's not. And when I see somebody and I'm thinking through the legalities of, you know, well, did she really consent or not? The whole question of her consenting is really at the core play here. Because that's the question ad hayom hazeh, until this very day, right? What with cases of rape, and with cases of women being overcome, how often have the questions of did she consent? Or even tacitly, did she bring it on? Come to play in the question of sexual crimes. And I think the Gemara is having us think through that without actually saying those words. And what will happen within the codification that we're going to see is that what will happen within the sources we'll see is that the woman's allowed to do, you know, everything she possibly can to stop this. There's an example of a woman being allowed to do whatever she can in order to stop a fight as the one who's kind of seeing one person fight with another. And the Rambam is saying, if someone's really in the category of Rodef, which we're trying to define a lot of, you know, at least three categories of people being in that category, then I am going to allow this. But you're being caught up in this legality here? Well, in that legality, it's true. I might say there was consent, and therefore I have to be stopped in my tracks. Everyone agrees with that. But what's the equal and opposite? But everybody agrees that there's no way we're going to limit the law when it comes to someone who's a rodef, achare hanara, who's really pursuing a betrothed woman.
Why would the Talmud consider a woman who consents on threat of a death to have been consenting?
It's not consent. Said even better than what I was saying before, or said differently. In other words, the case is so putting into reality the kind of question mark vis-a-vis what I might think at any given time about even this sister, that, okay, if that's really it and it can be discerned, fine. Everyone would agree that theoretically under the law, we shouldn't then be able to kill him. But are you really, in other words, the equal and opposite side, but are you really going to think that? They're saying those words because in the adjudication of such cases, there is consideration given for, let's say, one's own free will and the choices one must make, even when they are two very, very deathly choices, deathly in different ways.
So a woman who's betrothed, first of all, I don't know the context, so I don't know why they're talking about a case in which it's a brother and sister, and whether the same woman would be considered a woman who is not,
the context is
not incestuous, and she
right.
consents anyway.
The context is the whole question of, does anyone ever say about a woman in this situation that she's consented, and thusly we do not see the pursuer as the criminally is.
A threat of death. Likes the guy, and even though she's been betrothed, she has sex.
Okay.
So that's she's subject to death penalty, I guess. Are they both subject to death penalty?
He's subject to a fine. But it's not if he didn't like her.
A man has sex with a married woman.
Well, then it's Eishadish. Then it's a whole right. Then it's a whole different story. Then it's adultery. Then it's an adultery. Case of adultery.
I wondered why they chose the example of a brother, and then it occurred to me maybe is it okay at times for a woman to live with her brother? They use cohabit in translation.
Here, yeah.
But the point is that points to the issue of sexual relations. Whereas if she were with, let's say, another man in those times, that brings as other questions. So the point being that, you know, here says with her brother, that makes it that she was there alone with him in the room or the building allowable and more pointed about the act of intercourse.
I think they're just skipping around what's really at heart. And what's really at heart is incest between a father and a child, girl. And they don't want to talk about it because that is still an extraordinarily prevalent occasion throughout all societies throughout all time. And talking about a sister and brother is somewhat, I think, for most people, more palatable because the age difference doesn't give the same sense of force of authority that the dependency of the girl child or girl, young girl on the father has.
Lots of sisters, daughters, right?
Right. But I think the rabbis and the Talmud are literally afraid to touch what they know is common in their own society. Mm.
On the previous page.
The age difference between a sister and a brother.
I'm not worried about the age difference.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about the position.
I'm talking about
authority.
I understand.
And that they knew incest between father and daughter is very prevalent.
Yeah. I mean, Rabbi Chista is the one who brings up the whole possibility that it's the brother and the sister. And when he does, it seems to be that that's what's, you know, basically his interpretation of, what's really going on here in this. So what's the case? So then we don't say that we assume that she gave consent and that he is raping and that he is a Rodef and that we can kill him.
That probably happens very often.
Well, let me say that additional piece is Rava's addition to the situation in order to try to really understand it. And then the final piece here is Rav Papa, who says, but everybody agrees that with Rav Yehuda, that is, if she did have this consent, getting to the issue of consent. Now, if it's a matter of trying to touch a situation of a different relationship by going in through another one, I'm not positive that that's an approach, but it's an interesting thought because we have the father and the son in the first part of the Mishnah, and we could always play with those kinds of boundaries if we're looking at the Gemara as being somewhat, you know, using language to arrive, looking at language to arrive at one relationship versus another, right? And not have it be so static. In this case, though, if it is about the brother and the sister, I'm not sure that it's about, they would live together at certain points in their lives, and they would be old enough to actually have, you know, the reproductive systems to the point where they would have, you know, sexual relations as a possibility. And they're saying, you know, that it's only by threat of death that she would consent to this with her brother, and therefore don't kill him and don't kill her. And maybe, back to the father, it's saying in the household, you could have brought him to court when he was a Ben Sorer Moray, or there was only a certain window of time where you can actually take him to the town elders to stone him. But now, you know, with your son, just like, right, you're not going to kill the son or the whole relationship of the son breaking in and the father breaking in and the son, that, you know, don't, as a father, kill your kid. We might fine him if he's of legal status, and that fine goes to the father. So if you want to make it about relationships, this is, again, we said last time and the time before, if we were Rishonim and we were writing our own commentaries to the Gemara, that's a very plausible kind of, from the nature of this Gemara, to say, would a brother and a sister ever really living together at an age where actually this could happen? And can the father then be the one who's in the situation of having to decide, is that crime worthy of punishment by actually taking the life of his kid? Because we've had those kinds of situations in the whole Perek. So it's a really interesting place to go, and one of our Rabbanim might have gone there. I'll now go and look in terms of my studies to see, hey, maybe someone went there.
It could be different ways.
It just seems to me that if the issue is, if the focus is supposed to be really, it makes the most sense that the issue is about consent, because there is no good reason to have consent between a brother and a sister. Whereas between any other man and a woman, besides a father and a daughter, you know, that there might be some attempt for there to be an excuse for why there might be consent. So it seems very clear that whether it's the custom or whether there was a problem that there was fathers and daughters and all of that, that this is not, that this is about the one situation where there cannot be any excuse for consent. If that's the focus, then that does make sense that there's that's the relationship.
Okay.
I mean, well,
bringing it back down to consent, right? Because I
don't know if it's that absolute. I mean, there, John Irving explored that. It was a hotel in Hampshire. I mean, that was a consensual relationship between a brother and sister, which was
okay.
Not that. It's the same. I'm not sure it's so absolute.
No. So where does that take you vis-a-vis the response you're making? Flesh that out a little bit more.
I was disagreeing with the fact that one can never, under any circumstances, consent in a situation like that.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm disagreeing with that.
Well, according to Torah law, let's put it this way. The rabbis want us... I'm sorry.
There's no excuse for consent. I don't mean that there's no consent. I mean that a woman might say, I'm separated from my husband, or I didn't really mean to be betrothed or anything else, but there's no good explanation for why.
Religiously. So that goes back maybe there's no good reason to consent as a matter of Jewish law, bringing Jewish law, but
yes, I'm talking about Jewish law, not John.
But differentiating from the case where he's considered
Right. Well, there's Torah law, and the rabbis for sure want to uphold Torah law. Yet, in humanity, as evidenced through the kind of artifacts you're talking about, you could see that in societies, there might be this willingness to even give oneself over. And Rav, by saying what he says, Rebbe, by saying what he says, like, okay, if that was really the case, that I could discern that, then everybody agrees you don't kill him. And my take on the whole little piece of the sugya where we are is, but come on! That's not the case. The Mishnah said if someone's actually pursuing a betrothed Nara, we don't think of her as having given consent. We kill him. And the continuation of the text is going to show us exactly what options lie in front of us in order to make sure it happens. And it gets to the point where, again, last time we said, very difficult sometimes to actually bring ourselves over there and actually do the job of using the lethal force. And what is it that we are required to do vis-a-vis the lethal force? In Jewish law, A, you are required to step in. You're not required to call 911 on a cell phone. There was no such thing as major pages in Prakim chapters about how the police come into action and what kind of emergency call you can make. You're required. Part of what we're getting down to in the nitty-gritty of the end of the chapter here is that you're required to act. And you'll see that in the next part of the text. Look at what Abaye says. Abaye Amar. So Abaye then chimes in. The Mishnah refers to a case where it's possible to save the woman by disabling one of the pursuer's limbs.
Yeah.
Oh!
It begged it.
Yeah, and we're going to come right back to that, so hold on. The Rabbi Yonatan ben Shaul he. And the following is the opinion of Rabbi Yonatan ben Shaul. The Tanya, who has a brighter. Rabbi Yonatan ben Shaul said, if a pursuer was pursuing his fellow with intent to kill him, and it was possible to save the intended victim by disabling one of the pursuer's limbs, and a rescuer did not save the victim through those means, but instead killed the guy, he killed the pursuer, neheragalav, the rescuer is put to death on the pursuer's account. In the Mishnah's case too, the attack could have been thwarted by simply injuring the pursuer, and he was thus not subject to execution during the attack. Consequently, he must pay the 50 shekel fine for violating the sister. Now, it goes back to the sister situation, because we're inside the sister situation. But really, the reality is that it's exploring the whole notion of rodef and the notion of really having to come and take responsibility. Even though, in that case, in that one little legal case, there was some kind of consent here, and how could there be consent? Because the Torah law says there's never consent, and absolutely it was only at the risk of her death that she had to do this, and that's the only time, really, that she could kill, right? Because if someone says to you, violate a sexual crime, what are you allowed to do in our tradition? You're allowed to be killed. And the fact is that in this case, or someone who's going to do that can be killed. And the fact is that there's such an outside, outlier case. Come back to the Brita here. But what do we do when we know someone's a Rodef? What is this Brita adding to our understanding now of our exertion of lethal force? That if I have the possibility of saving this Na'ara by chopping off the limb of the one who is in the category of Rodef, the one who is the pursuer, I ought to do that first. Because in a case where there's any kind of taking of the life, and I could have done that, right? I might now be responsible. So it brings us to a level of the consideration of lethal force. What we ought to do first when it comes to actually dealing with a Rodef. And Gemara often does this, right? It brought you one little case, and within the case it brings you a Brita. Some people might read it that it's only applicable in that one small case. And some people say, huh, that's really applicable in all the cases. I might think that that informs me about how we make legislation. So what does that sound like in terms of policy? Where he could have cut off one of the limbs versus actually taken the entire life of someone. What's that? An eye for an eye. So maybe it means you go directly to the limb that's in question and he's putting his hand to steal money, you chop off the hand. He's about to violate the Na'ara, talking the limb.
It seems like they're trying to write the death penalty out completely. I mean, they think the most unpalatable situation or relationship.
Mm-hmm.
One that most normal people don't even want to speak about, much less actually deal with.
Right.
And your first intent would be to want to maybe kill somebody. And then they say, all right, you can't kill them. But now they're also saying, cut off a limb. I personally think it's harder to cut a limb off a living person than to just kill them. I mean, it's easier to put an axe in someone's head than to...
Well, disabling, not necessarily
yeah,
disabling.
Yeah,
I don't
think
disabling.
Yeah.
Disabling.
It's
just
the leg.
That's hard to kill.
Okay, so this is the policy of today's modern way of saying it that is actually at stake here. This Gemara has been used in the law schools of Israel to talk about the policy of the police vis-a-vis the notion of, do I shoot to disable or do I shoot to kill? So this is the spot. They take out of context of this whole situation with this youth, which we're able to do with our Torah verses, and we're able to do with our Brightas. And the Brita says, if you were able to cut off a limb or disable a limb, because it could be both, by the way, they're seeing it, most Mefarshim, practically all. So the question of maim or shoot to kill comes up vis-a-vis this Gemara. And it goes on in the text to talk about even when there's fights. But we're going to stick here for a moment and say, so, okay, how do we understand this now? If we apply this back to the case of the Gemara or the Mishnah, and how do we understand it in modernity? In the case of the Mishnah, if someone's pursuing another person to kill him, right? Again, the Mishnah, three cases. Or someone's running after a male to do this, or someone's going after this betrothed Na'ara. In other words, cases that absolutely are crimes against human beings for which they could pay with their lives. Do I have the responsibility to disable them first? So, you could you could look back into the Torah and say, boy, they're making people pay with limbs. You could look back at the Torah and say that. And the source we're going to see that in, take one of those and pass it along. The source we're going to see that in is in a verse, in a section from Deuteronomy and Parsha Ki Teitzeh. No, everybody take one. There just might be enough. I made I should have made it like the Amida.
Right.
I should have made that one more blessing. So one person is going to have to share with a partner.
I don't understand where.
Is it what extra?
Oh, no.
Oh, that's a.
Oh, no. Is it that extra?
Do
you have an extra? Fall under the same
do
category
have an extra over there?
These
yes.
Three
and you pass it?
Is that like, say, at least a double standard? I mean, in other words, if you're not betrothed, but you're violated, it doesn't count. Or if it's your brother, then it doesn't,
right.
it seems very
interesting. One might think that this situation where the brother actually threatens her life and says, we're going to have relations or you're going to die, and she consents. Why wouldn't we put her under that category?
Yeah.
And that's, so the rabbis in that case say, oh, well, you know, if she really consented, right?
Well, it says allows to violate her, which to me is not the same thing as consent.
Right, but, well, it allows, and it's certain, okay, so we can make that, we can parse that.
I'm going to kill you unless you let me do this, okay?
Right, so.
How is that consent?
So you could say that, you know, how can we not put her in the category and kill him because he's pursuing her? The only reason I can think, right, is because they're saying kind of like the same. A, they could be saying, ah, that kind of situation, is it really ever going to come up? They're saying, if that was the situation, then, of course, we couldn't kill him because you're right, legally, you're kind of presenting us with a situation where we'd have to agree that we would never kill him. But, by the way, that's only in that very tiny little category where, in our tradition, there's no one given consent to incest if you're living by Torah law. And, by the way, if you could have cut off a limb, you'd have done a better job in this case than actually killing the guy. But we're not holding you guilty for murder, by the way.
Well, but by Torah law, you're not allowed to sodomize a man, is not allowed to sodomize a man either.
Well,
that's in there.
Right, so that's in there as one you could kill him for. And so, ultimately, they are pushing us to the point where the case is that we're seeing people who are rodef, who are, you know, pursuing others to violate them, and that they're going to pay with their lives. Now the question of this braita is, but are they going to pay with their lives, or do I have to disable them versus actually killing them? If you want then to say, does the Torah ever have a place where we kind of see corporal punishment really happen? Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, even if we know that Bava Kamma legislates that out of business and says you're gonna pay some mine, you're gonna pay some money fines, the Torah at least, you know, says it pretty clearly that there is a certain case where she's going to pay. She's going to pay with a hand. What's that case? It's this verse here in Deuteronomy, the first situation from Deuteronomy. Ki yinatsu anashim yachdav, if two men get into a fight with each other, ish v'achiv v'karva eshet ha'achad, and two men get into a fight, and the wife of one comes up to save her husband. Lahatzil et ha'isha miyad makehu. From the hand, if she comes up to save him from the hand of the other, v'shalcha yada, and she puts out her hand, v'hechazika b'mivushav, and she seizes him by the genitals. V'katzota et kapa, you'll cut off her hand, lo tachos einecha, and you'll show no pity. Now, I bring it because vis-a-vis the cutting off of limbs to pay for crimes, they saw this as a wrongful crime for which she needed to pay with a hand. There shall be no pity. If you look, down below, intervention in the fight. This is the JPS commentary. This, you know, five-volume Jewish Publication Society, exploring the very simplest sense, the ancient kind of legal parameters that go along with Torah law. The punishment seems remarkable since the woman's act is performed with legitimate intentions. And since the Bible nowhere else prescribes mutilation, except as a talionic measure-for-measure punishment for mutilation, in fact, Talmudic exegesis took cut off her hand to mean that the woman should be fined with monetary value of her hand. As noted in Excursus 24, that's another part of the commentary, but that is not the plain sense of the text. Some commentators explain the severity of the biblical laws reflecting abhorrence at the woman's immodesty. Others believe that it reflects a feeling that for a woman to seize a man's genitals is an intolerable humiliation. It's an intolerable humiliation for him. Still others hold that the danger of injuring the man's genitals, thereby threatening the ability to father children, is what makes the woman's act so objectionable. And cut off her hand, it's a common to inflict punishment on the part of the body with which an offense is committed. Now, take that back to our Gemara, that it's common to inflict punishment on the part of the body with which the crime is committed. And the question would be, would you be allowed in such a situation as a person about to commit a crime against a woman, would you be able to actually go through with that dismemberment? Rambam is going to actually include that equal and opposite reflection in his code of law. So that we get down to the core idea here that he's really committing a crime and this person's lineage could be cut off, and we wouldn't say a word about it.
So there's a bit of a confusion here, at least in my mind.
Okay.
The Mishnah uses these three examples as a situation where you can take the life of the pursuer to save the person's life, the pursuer's life. It's not,
It's either or. We said a couple weeks ago, there are two thoughts about that. Either you're saving the one who's about to commit the crime from actually committing the sin and therefore being in the category of sinner, or it's truly about her, especially in the case of the Nara, because the Gemara uses that language that you're saving her with his taking his life. The pursuers.
So I should have come to the class.
Is that the piece that you're stating as the question?
Yeah, because if you now are talking about instead of killing this pursuer, using the least a less drastic remedy, so to speak, and you're now going to just take a limb, so you've defeated protected the pursued, but you've totally defeated the whole purpose, as I understood it, of the rule, which is I thought the only way you get around the problem of not taking one life to save another is you're saving this person from a further life of sin and so on. So that doesn't fit with that rationale to even be talking about doing something less than killing him.
Right. It doesn't. And that's the surprising part. And that is, in essence, the question that it's begetting, is it that I really have to hold back after you told me that I'm really saving this person from such a life? Or I'm saving society?
The sinner hasn't yet sinned.
Right. You are protecting. You're preventing you from doing crimes.
It's the same thing. You're preventing
him from sinning.
But it was because of the rest of his life he was
going to be... Al Shem Sofon
Neharag. Upon his ultimate end, even if I bring him to the Beit Din and he gets warned, right? But it's true, I had to bring him to the Beit Din and get warned, so he had the chance. So now I'm giving him the chance by doing this. And maybe the concept and ideal of tshuva, of that, you know, kind of rehabilitative justice is at play versus completely retributive justice, where retribution is at the core. And so that tension is in here, very much so.
I want to go back to the question of Ben Sarira Mora. We know from the Mishnah that you discussed that a crime against the body, against an individual, prevent crime from taking place,
yep.
Save the perpetrator by killing him.
Okay.
Against religion or something that disrupts the community.
Murder.
We don't.
Murder. Rashi said it was murder. That in the end he will be a murderer.
Yeah.
Who would be?
Oh,
the Ben Sarer Amar, their stubborn and rebellious son.
Okay, but he's not a Rodef.
Yeah.
So. He's not a Rodef. He's actually committing kind of a social wrong.
Right.
By gluttony and drunkenness and petty theft, whatever it is he's doing. I know that the Gemara says that his habit will become more and more expensive. Eventually, he will have to steal a large amount. He may become a highwayman. He may kill somebody on the road and so on. But you could make that argument for the person who was a Mechalel Shabbat. Eventually, he will become such a degenerate personality that there will be nothing that he
yeah,
can
yeah.
Do.
By the
you
by,
can make the argument.
Okay, so you could make the argument, right?
It's the worst crime, actually. Maybe.
You could make that argument, except that this last Mishnah stands against that argument.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you could, no doubt about it, and that's the discussion that is somehow appearing in here.
So yeah. The answer is the argument then that he'll become a murderer if you don't prevent him.
Right. Exactly. Jay.
I think this little piece might make it easier on people who don't particularly feel like killing somebody, who might feel that their obligation is to kill the attacker, and this gives them the out and might increase the likelihood of people becoming involved in trying to prevent a crime like this if they know that there's still Yotzei, if they merely disable the person, that there isn't an obligation on them to kill someone.
Nice. I think we're going to see that the Rambam agrees with you. And that the Rambam in defining the mitzvah is going to go that direction.
Number one, in regards to this statement, most armies, from the comment of this editor, most armies choose the 765, 765 bullet to disable the enemy, because once you disable a soldier, you take two more out of commission to take care of him. So it helps in the battle. So the purpose of all in war is to make people wounded rather than to kill them. That's the general. But going back into the key in Sushna Anshin, so a wife sees her husband fight with somebody else. So one of them is Rodef. She thinks that the other guy is the Rodef, who wants to kill her husband. So decided not to kill him, just to disable him to a certain amount of time so the fight will stop. If she would kill him, that's okay, because that's a mitzvah, you know. You kill the Rodef, you need to do that. But she decided just to disable her, so because she decided to disable her, she's being punished by penalty of cutting her head off and her end off.
Good. So you're going to see that the Rambam also takes care of that business. He says, how could this possibly be? That's basically what he's doing, another part of his project, which is why I brought us the Rambam today. Because between the references that the Gemara is imagining that we're going to make, back to Devarim, back to Deuteronomy, which we made today, and between this whole understanding of the question of the Rodef, and can I really take this guy's limb or not, and why do I see that the woman's punished here, which you're asking, the Rambam's going to codify things, and we're going to get to that tonight, to see how it's codified and how it stands up against that kind of, for the Rambam at least, erroneous thinking.
But maybe it's the very choice of her choosing his genitals. I mean, if she poked out his eye, it's sort of a very selective choice on her part.
For the Torah, definitely. According to this commentary that we looked at in
the
JPS.
That would be the rationale.
Yeah.
That she, in a way, maybe she's going for the humiliation rather than for the prevention.
Yeah, yeah.
There were other choices to prevent.
Yeah.
So one could say that about the Torah.
Disabling is every intention. The person had every intention to save one. But in pursuing somebody, he killed the person while trying to disable. I don't understand why he loses his life. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. He is a good Samaritan. And if he disabled the person, he's a hero. If he kills the person, he himself is killed while the other person goes free.
Well, if he's a real Rodef, he's not guilty. He doesn't lose his life.
But that's what it said here that...
In this one little situation legally where we said the Na'ara really gave either a, she what was the distinction that the
allowed
versus consented even. There we say he only pays the fine. But really the lesson of the text is, right, I ought to dismember someone versus entirely kill them. And it's only, in a certain sense, what we call in the Gemara, ahava amina. Is it that I don't have permission to fully take this guy's life, or is it not? Well, where you can dismember someone and disable someone and stop the crime, maybe what this is suggesting by having this text in play is that that's what we do. For sure, in the policies about police shooting at people who are committing crimes, they want to go towards the disabled before it completely shoots a kill in certain places. Other places say shoot to kill. This text made us think about that issue, right? And it makes us think about it in a way that's, you know, just through the narrative of one, what looks like very tiny particular case, but it's asking us to think expansively about the entire category of this pursuer.
If it were the daughter of a different mother, same father, a different wife, is achatzo still the word that we use?
Chatzichoto is the same.
Yeah, I'm saying. It may not be as unusual.
It's the family still. It's still family line.
Oh, I'm not suggesting it's okay, but I'm saying it may not be as uncommon as we imagine in thinking of it in contemporary terms.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, I mean, it may be that there are times.
Again, this exploration of the family structures is an interesting question. Let's go to the Rambam. Let's go to the Rambam, because I think it's worth seeing. I've brought you a page from Rambam's Mishneh Torah. The Rambam's Mishneh Torah is a code. I'm sorry, I have several volumes of the Rambam in English upstairs. I don't have this section in English, so I apologize. Those who would like to follow, I'll try to get you into the text. I've made some underlinings in the Rambam. You have a text there?
No, we have
it. Okay. So, the Rambam in Hilchot Rotseach Ushmirat Nefesh. So, these are the laws regarding murderers and the protection of people's lives. So he starts and he explores the whole category of Rodef. Remember the Rambam in his Hakdama, in his Preisi, to the whole Mishneh Torah said, I'm here to explain Torah Shebaal Peh. I'm here to explain the Gemara. Where Gemara learning has been lost among the Jewish people, I'm going to give you a discourse on the essential elements of the Talmud, and he's not just going to restate them. He's going to kind of fill in the conversations. Look where I have the underlines to begin the look into the Rambam. Aval. I am 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines down where I had the center text underlined. Aval, but instead of those guys who have to be brought to court because they've committed a crime and you know it and you have to drag them because they've committed murder. Every time you start something in Jewish text, you have to say it. But, oh, wait a minute, there's one other point. The guys who have to be dragged to the Beit Din. We've talked about this before, too. Like, if a guy kills somebody, right? How are they dragged to the Beit Din? So how are they dragged to the Beit Din? I had an interesting conversation in the Beit Midrash this week. I had about, I was learning with a chavruta, and I don't know, 7 guys in the Beit Midrash, and we're all discussing this question. Like, where are the Mishnahs for the police back in the times of the Mishnah. And where are, you know, you have to go to the precinct, and how is the precinct set up, and, you know, like, why don't they have precincts, and there's really not a whole lot of understanding we have. Why is that? Well, for a really important reason. We're responsible. We're responsible to drag those people into the Beit Din. Not some force. And it's an interesting concept that, you know, the two people who saw it are many times responsible for going to gather a few people and dragging those people into the court. And we see that several times in text. But if it's not that I got to go drag this guy, I'm in the middle of seeing the pursuer almost ready to do this crime against this person, and I call this person a rodef, and I'm now convinced, aval rodef achar chavero lahargo, but a person who is pursuing a fellow citizen, it's not a chaver in this case, it's not a friend, it's a fellow citizen of Israel, lahargo, to kill him, afilu hayah rodef katan. Remember we said in our Gemara, it said even if it's a minor, who we normally wouldn't hold responsible for any kind of crime, so he uses the word katan, there's him bringing in Gemara that he wants you to know. Hare kol Yisrael mitzavin lahatzil hanirdaf. Every Jewish person is obligated to save the one being pursued, miyad harodef, from the hands of the pursuer. Va'afilu b'nafsho shel rodef, and even with the life of the one pursuing. Now, where does he fall out on this question of am I saving the one being chased, or am I saving the one pursuing? He's falling out on the one being chased. Halacha Zion. Ketzad im his hiruhu. How is it? What happens when they actually warn him? Warn the pursuer. V'harehu rodef acharav. And he still goes and pursues to go do this murder. Af al pi shelo kibel alav hatra'ah. Even though he didn't accept upon himself the warning. Kevan she'adayin hu rodef hareze neherag. We do say that he is a rodef and that he can be killed. Ve'im yecholim lahatilo, and here's the part with now our discussion from tonight. Ve'im yecholim lahatilo be'ever me'evere harodef. But if it can be that I can save the one being pursued by disabling or dismembering the rodef, kagon she'yaku oto bechet. For example, I could shoot an arrow at him. So it's not just simply like, you know, take an axe and hack something. I can shoot an arrow, be'evan, or I can pick up a stone and throw a stone at the guy, be'saif, or I can take a sword or a blade, v'yikta'u et yado, and cut off his hand, yishabru et reglo, or I could break his leg, yisamu et einav, or I can blind him. Osin, you do it. Ve'im, einan yecholin lechavin ulahatzilo elim kein harguhu lirodef hare elu horginoto af apishazayin lo harag. And if it's possible that you can't really get to any of this kind of making the decision to go and do one of these kinds of acts. If you cannot aim, if you cannot bring yourself to any of these saving kinds of measures, right? Then you kill him. Af al pi shedayin lo harag, even though he has yet to commit the crime of murder. Shene'emar, as it said, katzvota et kapa lo tachos einecha. You cut off her hand, you have no mercy. So what did it do with the pasuk? What did it do with the verse, you cut off her hand and you have no mercy? Made it into mercy? It's exactly the question, Ron, that you asked before. I now use the very verse that I blamed her and I cut off her hand to say, the pursuer, you thought that you just had to cut off his hand in the middle of the act and you accidentally killed him? By the way, upends the entire Braita too. So even the case about the Na'ara, who's the sister, if I kill him, I kill him. This is, it's interesting that the question of whether or not having committed the crime comes in for the Rambam, right, even though he didn't actually do the killing, that's the Rambam asking some of the questions that we have around our tables. Is it possible that even without committing the crime, we would have him do it? Because he knows that that's an issue.
Can't we take a preemptive action?
What would you say from the sources we've studied right now? The question, Richard, is whether or not the Gemara in any kind of relationship between one person pursuing another in the detail level can be learned expansively out to here. You know, that's the question that the Talmud always wants us to think about. Do I apply this only with some limited sense? Or do I apply this to a whole societal level? For sure, the Braita that we looked at right now about actually disabling a limb versus actually murdering somebody, and in this one case he would have been held responsible for it, that is simply asking the question, with the use of lethal force, do I shoot to maim or do I shoot to kill? And we still think about that today. Israel police force thinks about that today. What restraint do I need to show? So on the opposite side of your question is, do I say to my military, do I say to my police officers, exercise some restraint? Equal and opposite side of your question.
Sorry, Richard.
Yeah,
right. You didn't get what you wanted.
So there is a Rodef that is after a person, and we are trying to stop him by killing him or stopping him, but he is much more efficient than us, and he killed the person that he wanted to kill, while we are trying to stop him from doing that. And we killed him later, or we didn't kill him. Should we bring him before we kill him to judgment after he killed the other guy? Or should we can continue and kill him on the spot? What is the case in that? He's more efficient than us, than the vigilantes that try to stop him.
Too late. Drag him to the Beit Din.
So if he was more efficient, we need to stop everything and take him to
Yeah.
We cannot kill him anymore.
He's not a road deaf any longer. He's just not a Rodef. Right. Well, in a certain case, that's right. What a turn. What a turn.
In this passage from Deuteronomy about the life transcendence, we were to apply the reasoning used in the Mishnah to this case. Actually, the wife is the Rodef. And we have to disable her before she causes some... I don't think that...
The Torah kind of sees it in such a case, but the Rambam is obviously using the verse to say, wait a minute, I don't know. I want to see it quite the opposite, that we have no mercy on this guy who's really the Rodef in this situation.
I'm not seeing that. Why are you saying that?
I'm saying that because the use of the verse as a proof text, as a Shene'emar, and that we have no mercy on this guy whose life we were supposed to save maybe by putting an arrow in his side, ultimately gives us the sense that, yes, you could simply read the Peshat and say, like with her, we had no mercy and we cut off her hand because she committed a crime, but really because the verse is used to allow for us to say the one who's really attacking, right, who is, even in that case as we sit here and read it today, not understanding why it got to that level, that the two men fighting, that she's really trying to save him. If she's really striving to save him, then we have no mercy on him, not on her. So I'm just bringing...
Isn't he saying that you have an obligation in the first instance
to do something less than kill them.
Correct.
And if that doesn't work, then you can.
Correct.
Kill it.
That is. And then there's just the use of this.
Isn't that what the Brita says?
The Brita is saying that as well. And what I'm remarking about is that the Rambam, who's using the verse, and the Brita, nor the Brita, you know, brought it up. The Brita didn't bring it up, nor the Mishnah, you know, in terms of how we kind of treat this,
yeah.
Is just using this verse to kind of, if you will, put out there the language that if you really were to categorize someone as the Rodef, and she, the wife, categorized someone as the Rodef, and therefore she tried to break up this fight, maybe that we needed to see that the no mercy on him.
Okay, but Richard's question, isn't the teaching of the Mishnah and the Brita and the Rambam here that in the case of Iran, for example, if it's a real Rodef, you should try and negotiate, you should try and use less drastic means, and if they don't work, then you have to kill them?
I think you could make very serious, you know, textually based political arguments in the Knesset, especially given the atmosphere for the consumption of the Gemara as informing our thinking as a Jewish people. You could make that argument. You could also then answer that argument with the whole kind of question of when do we exercise restraint and when do we not. The Rambam, if you then brought that in as a proof text on top, says lo tachos, you know, don't have mercy, and don't worry if you went one step where you thought you could just cut it off by bombing the plant. Maybe you needed to do more. You're absolutely right. One could do those things. The actions of governments, though, need to be ultimately decided.
But the group here on the leftists. From our vantage point, we're taking comfort in something that I don't think they would be so comfortable with. I'm with that, by the way.
Yeah, Henry.
You know, the nuclear plant is like cutting off.
Henry's got the floor. We're not going nuclear.
It works.
Yeah.
Sending a virus or something. Yeah.
This is my perspective, and I'm surprising myself by taking a leftist perspective. But I think the whole thrust of this isn't around giving sanction to the savior who's going after the rodent to stop something. I think the whole thrust of it is to remind the savior that the savior has the potential for sin, as well as the rodef, and as well as even the victim, possibly. The whole thrust of it is to make the save, is to really, ahead of time, teach the savior that you can violate God's will as well in your act of trying to do something good, and that you should watch out that you don't sin, that you should be careful to stop yourself if you have an ability to not kill, then come short of killing. Just do what you need to do, and be careful of killing a rodef in an instance where the rodef isn't subject to the death penalty, because then you're substituting your own judgment about punishment for God's judgment of punishment.
Which is why I'm always curious about those guys yelling on the subway about Jesus. Because I think, do you really think that you're the one who's supposed to tell us?
Henry, the notion here that you're bringing forward is definitely it's a core worry of the Rambam. Okay, so I don't know if it's whatever you call it, left, right, conservative, liberal. The Rambam's definitely thinking religiously about when we are going to take life into our own hands. As do rightists and leftists. Right? The Rambam is saying, in look down at Tet, it's the first wide line. Look at Halacha Tet. Af zu mitzvat lo tase. This is a mitzvah of a lo tase mitzvah. In other words, keep yourself from doing what? Shelo lachus al nefesh harodef. Don't have mercy. Don't have mercy on the one who is pursuing. If you're worried that you're going to be called less than any good Samaritan, right? That's not exactly what we call it. We just call it a chiyuv. We call it, we are obligated to save either the person that we need to save or the soul of the one. Lo lachus. Lefichach horu chachamim. Therefore, the sages taught that the small fetus, the near-born child that it's difficult to give birth to, mutar lachatoch ubar b'me'eha. Back to the Mishnah that we learned about the abortion by operatively removing the rodef, that is the unborn child. That even to that point, your mercy, you think you're going to sin in such a way against this child. Now imagine the debate that the medieval Jews had with burgeoning and more severe Catholic policies regarding abortions. Put this in context of a world where the Rambam is stating this, not only because that's kind of the Mishnaic outlook, but that we're reiterating the notion of our policies regarding abortion. So even though this is kind of, quote-unquote, the hot political issues of our age, these are issues of the religious outlook that we must understand in terms of the Rambam's understanding, and for sure... No. Head is not out. We know that from the Mishnah. It goes on. Bain basam, bain bayad, whether it's with the medicinal methodology that we knew, or it's with your hands. Now, by the way, note, whole history of herbal kinds of abortive, you want to call them medicines, you want to call them potions, that the ancient world knew. One social cultural history of these kinds of things we could look at, you know, at different times forever studying abortion in a little bit more of detail. Because this internal, not with the head out, this fetus, this unborn child is like a rodefaim, misha hotzi rosho. But if the head is out, just to be clear about what happens then, ein nogin bo she'ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh. We don't say one life for the other in that case. We don't call him a rodef anymore. V'zehu tivo shel olam. And that's
what the case.
And that is the way the world is accustomed to continue rolling. That is the way the world is accustomed to being. That is the natural law placed into the world by God. This is a phrase in the Rambam literature that we have to explore very deeply to really understand what he's actually saying, right? On the one hand, he's saying, this is the way the world works, very plain sense, because it's got a plain sense in our tradition, and he's saying philosophically, this is the natural order and law that the world goes by, because it'll say something like this when the sun and the moon continually go about their patterns, right?
Did you answer Ron's question?
What was the exact question?
Did you let the mother die?
The mother,
the wash is out.
You have you're not allowed to surgically remove a child whose head is out.
No, you're allowed to remove it as long as you keep him alive. You are not allowed to kill him to save the mother.
Correct.
So let the mother die. But there is understanding through society that you always save the one who has the ability to reproduce or save the smaller one. Like if you are on an airplane with your kid and the mask is coming down, your obligation is to put the mask on yourself first before you put it on your kid.
So the
trick in this argument is you always say the body that is able to reproduce or save later on other issues, then if somebody that has no present almost is nothing, and kill somebody with past and future.
I hear you searching for a good general clout, like a good clout shield same. I'm not sure that I have a cloud shield, Sami, that there's a general principle here that I can learn from this situation of the Mishnah. I don't know that I would also say the Nusach, the phrasing of we let her die. I think that over time we tried to be very true to this religious core value of we don't take one life for another, and therefore we're dealing with the situation the best we can with whatever medical knowledge we had at different steps every generation. The issue was discussed. The Diaspora Museum put on a beautiful exhibit about Jews in medicine. The catalog was a fantastic exploration. And this Mishnah and an abortion in of itself as a discussion orientation is a fascinating kind of history. What could we do more to preserve the life of both if there was trouble during Leida, if there was trouble during birth? This was a pursuit medicinally of you know, Jewish thinkers. So commentaries around this Mishnah that grew out of it, kind of like where you might say, if you want to make an argument that the Mishnah was at all a textbook for lawyers and for doctors, whatever medicinal knowledge we knew, we tried to stick into the Mishnah, and then we tried to put it into the Gemara, and we tried to continue creating commentaries. You know, some of these kinds of pursuits would have to be looked at there, and things could change as our understandings change. I don't think there's a hard and fast clout.
Any help once the head is out, that's it. I mean, that's the most difficult, that's the biggest part of baby. Once the head is out, they just pull the baby out and the birth is
a yeah, right. Like, I mean, once the head is out, right, the whole child's body, unless there's a deformity or something like that.
You can save the mother because the baby's born.
So, why are they discussing to let the mother die? Yeah.
So, this is correct for you.
Yeah, Dan.
Rambam would have done us all a favor as a doctor especially and also a genius if he had simply said we have the principle nefesh. He should have said that this is not a nefesh.
Yeah.
And it would have been easy. But this doesn't really, it's not totally unsatisfying because a fetus, certainly to our way, my way of thinking at least, is not acting as a rodent.
Yeah. So it's a hard, that's possibly the most difficult application of the category of rodent. But it's one that was made, and it was one that was made in the context of don't have mercy because of how difficult it is, I think. So it's not, you know, not that it can satisfy us, as you say. But it's there. A translation of... So just to go over it one more time while we're here, right? Tet. It's a mitzvah that you have to keep yourself from having too much mercy, right, on the soul of the one who is the pursuer. In other words, when you're thinking about taking the life of anybody in the category of the one who is pursuing,
no mercy.
Therefore, Rambam says, the sages, and I'll translate it just a little bit of a different way, the sages applied the category of pursuer to an almost born child who's threatening the life of a mother. Therefore, that unborn child that whose head is not out of the birth passage, birth canal, can be surgically removed and thus the life of the mother saved. But if the head comes out, we do not surgically remove the child quickly in order to immediately save the life of the mother. So thank you for the great clarifying and discussions and explorations and living with the questions and trying to feel, you know, kind of where the law went, I thought tonight with the Rambam and how the Gemara is expressed through his writing, brings us to coming to the last several passages next week. We're going to make a siyum next week. Rabbi Wechsler is going to offer some of his thoughts about the nature of this perek at the beginning of the class and what this part of Gemara is dealing with in his sense. Then I will make a last limud with some of the material, and then I understand we're going to share a l'chaim and some challah. By the way, I will be still... How do I stop this? I will be still on the 19th, holding a